LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Load the catapults. Infantry, form up for advance. Archers ready.
Archers! Knock, knock!
Hold the line! Stay with me! You find yourself alone, riding in green fields with the sun on your face. Do not be troubled, for you are in Elysium, and you're already dead! Brothers, what we do in life echoes in eternity.
Archers! Ignite! Ignite! Ignite!
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Mark Olley, who joins us to discuss his book, The Disappearing Ninth Legion. At its height, the Roman Empire dominated 5 million square kilometres and over 20% of the entire population of the Earth, conquered by its vast army whose prowess in battle is the stuff of legend. Amid the triumph, however, there was, of course, tragedy, and sometimes curious conjunctions of both. Perhaps the most notorious is the tale of the Ninth Legion, a once proud fighting force among the very best the Empire deployed, who enjoyed victory after glorious victory across centuries before disappearing without trace. The theories about their vanishing are Legion themselves, but none thus far has unearthed their fate. In The Disappearing Ninth Legion, Mark Olley traces their history and tests the theories in an effort to shed light on just what may have befallen them. Along the way, we relive the might and majesty of the Roman Empire and its awesome power to both build and destroy. In particular, we cast our minds back to the Empire's attempts to conquer Britain, regarded by many Romans as a near mythical land of dark sorcery and atavistic barbarism. The road ultimately leads to York, established by the 9th Legion in AD 71 as a northern outpost, and later expanded into one of the most important cities in Roman Britain. Many remains of the original Roman fortress lie under the foundations of York Minster, and excavations in modern times have revealed much about the rise and fall of one of the greatest empires the world has ever seen. But what of the disappearing 9th Legion? Hello and welcome, Mark, and thank you so much for joining us again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hello again, Greg.
Now, Mark, today we're going to be talking a little bit about a book that you co-wrote some time ago called The Disappearing Ninth Legion. Legion here referring to a legion of the Roman army, the best part of a couple of thousand years ago. Before we dive into all that, just tell listeners a little bit about your background and your work, just, you know, who you are.
Gosh, I've been an archaeologist most of my life. I started off studying for art, so I do graphic design and fine art. I went off into the music business for about 21 years as a drummer. I've had loads of different bands, several record deals. Retired in the 1990s, came back to book writing and back to archaeology. Wrote some regional history books, which was then made into a television series called Lost Treasures for ITV Granada. I've done three specials for Sky, and there's probably about, I think it's about three DVDs or four DVDs currently available of other productions. And then the current publishing run that I'm doing at the moment, I've got three books out. There's a DVD out at the moment. There's a lot of current material. We're working on various film and television proposals, and I also do medieval events. So that pretty well sums it up.
Okay, well, we're going to be talking, the overarching subject here is the Roman Empire. Now, of course, there are Romans today. There are people who are living in Rome and people who are from Rome. That's fine. In Italy, of course. So we're going to assume some knowledge here. We're not going to start picking apart and giving everyone the elementary 101 on this.
I was going to say, I'm just going to stop you dead there. 90% of Romans that were there in the Roman Empire did not come from Italy.
Of course, yeah, exactly. Well, this is one of the characteristics of the empire itself, was like very much how it operated. I simply threw that comment in because I have met people who just go, what are Romans? Who are Romans? You know, and so just to say that...
Yeah, people think of the sort of Mediterranean, tanned Italian, you know, dark eyes, dark hair, you know, typical sort of what you'd find in a tourist fishing village, and they naturally assume that all Romans look like that. And of course, the film and television industry sort of plays to that misconception. But Rome, I mean, Rome stretched, you know, all the way from the east, right the way across to the British Isles and some say Ireland, and down as far as North Africa, and up as far as Russia, the Russian borders, Germany and places like that.
Well, so, exactly. So just to put it to bed, there are Romans today, but this is not what we're talking about. I still marvel any time. I mean, today we're going to be talking about a particular aspect of the Roman Empire. Specifically, it's the aforementioned Ninth Legion, the legend around them and their conquest, their part in the conquest of Britain. But any time I come back to anything to do with the Roman Empire and, you know, the glory of Rome at its height, I still marvel that despite its end, despite its undoing and how it overreached itself, it was still the scope. I mean, there's been very little like it ever in human history. I mean, the sheer length of time, the ambition, the innovation. I mean, there really is something to marvel at, isn't it?
It's what happens when a large, diverse part of the human race combine. When they combine resources, art, styles, inventiveness, when it all comes together in a melting pot, then you finish up with something the size of the Roman Empire. Not something, like you say, that we've seen for probably the best part of 1,500 plus years. It's just a shame it did fragment at the end. It's not entirely gone, though. You could return to that, if you wish, at the end as a sort of summary, because it's not completely disappeared. It does soldier on in other forms.
So perhaps we should just say something then briefly about the structure of the Roman army. And obviously this, again, was something that evolved over time. But when we're referring to some of the language, some of the terminology we'll be using, including just the simple term, you know, legion, perhaps you just say something about the Roman army during the centuries that we're referring to, how that was constructed and how it operated.
Well, initially, a legion was 500 men or thereabouts, under various commanders and various subdivisions. They would have a ranking system of officers and people that had specific offices. But by the time we get to the Ninth Legion, where you're talking about the very beginning of the second century, you'd be looking at a legion probably somewhere in the order of 1,000 men. Give or take a few either way. I mean, the authorities are not 100% sure that figures were set in stone. Numbers could vary. Obviously, people, you know, died in conflict and other people were conscripted in, and, you know, so it varied. So you could reasonably say that the Ninth Legion at the beginning of the second century was somewhere in the order of 1,000 men. But then you've also got things like auxiliaries. Now, the auxiliaries are people from other countries and other social structures that are purposely selected for their skills. So, for example, southern Russians, the Scythians, the Pazariks, were superb horsemen. So you could have a unit of those with a particular legion, then other auxiliaries could be brought in from the locals, from wherever you were. So you might, in this particular instance, say, recruit a tribe, something like the Canovi or the Brigantes, to support you. And they would send a certain number of troops in. So they're not so much cannon fodder, but they're foot soldiers who are experienced at fighting techniques in use in that particular country. So they know what to expect. If you were dealing with the Welsh, which the Romans frequently were, they actually brought in the Germans to deal with the Welsh, because the Germanic peoples were used to fighting in forests and fighting in hills and mountains. So they were ideal to take on the Welsh, mainly because they marched 500 ordinary regular Roman troops in there somewhere at the beginning of the first century, and they just got absolutely hammered and were never seen again. So it's not just the 9th Legion that's vanished. So yes, they would be made up perhaps as many as 5,000 auxiliaries. And then you got support staff. And the whole issue of whether Roman soldiers could take on partners or not started to collapse around the end of the first century, and you find that a lot of the forts, fortifications, towns and cities have settlements built around them, and those settlements would have, shall we say, unofficial wives and unofficial families that the legionaries would have with them stationed there, plus all the support staff. So your metal workers, your sword makers, your farriers, cooks. In some cases in the bigger cities, so you're looking at Chester, York, and London and various other places around the country, they had amphitheatres, they had racetracks. So you would also have gladiators. You would have the full range of culture, Roman culture there. So by the time you've finished, you've probably got maybe somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 people in a legion, all told, and probably the same again that you'd be protecting in and around the particular town or city that you were stationed at. So if you had a Roman, if you had the Roman thing going on, it was actually quite a good thing. You know, you had a huge trading centre with a huge amount of skill of an international flavour, literally spring up, you know, on your doorstep. From the campaign forts of when they first got here in the 40s, 50s and 60s AD, a lot of those were turning to stone, from timber to stone, at the end of the first century, in the beginning of the second century. So really, that's the position we're in. I mean, York at that point was quite huge. It was quite enormous. It was a full-blown legionary fortress. Nowhere near as big as Chester. It was probably about 13 or 14 acres smaller than Chester. Chester's the biggest one in the world, but still very large, very, very large on a national scale. Probably in the top 10, possibly in the top 5 in terms of size of Roman settlement.
Well, yeah, the Roman model of empire expansion was very much one, in the first choice would be one of assimilation. And this is, you know, can be quite a clever strategy. Now, whether that happened without incident, or whether they had to go in and smash the locals up and then sort of say, look, you know, more of the same coming your way, play the game, if you see what I mean. But that was a basic tactic, wasn't it?
It was about 60-40, 60% in favour of going in there and smashing the living daylights out of them, and about 40%. In favour of selling the Roman ideal, shall we say. And that roughly speaking, that pattern is consistent across the Roman Empire. So to a lesser degree, when they went to what they would term barbarian countries, they had less. They had even less success selling Rome to them, so it would have been a different percentage. But then other places that were already had some measure of civilisation, they had no trouble selling the Roman ideal to at all. So in Britain, certainly, it was about 60-40. Julius Caesar had come over here. He came over in, I'm trying to get this right, I think it was 51 and 52, possibly 53 BC, somewhere in that order. He certainly came over in two waves, but actually didn't conquer Britain. The whole conquest of Britain thing is a fallacy. The first time he got wrecked in the Channel by bad weather, and he was opposed by quite a lot of British shipping that prevented him really from making a conclusive landing. And the second time he came here, he actually got as far as the beach, and he only lasted about 3 months before he had to make a peace with the southern tribes people and leave. And then you don't get the Romans back here again for nearly 100 years. They just stay away. They had this idea that to fight in this world is courageous, to fight in the next is foolish. That's one of the quotes in the book, something to that effect. And the idea was that Britain was the next world. It's beyond the mist, beyond the channel, covered in these foggy, misty trees and woods that go on forever, endless woodlands, full of nasty people that wanted to kill Romans. So initially, the planting of Julius Caesar's ideal, Roman ideal, takes place on the south coast, and only is successful to a point. It only kind of spreads part way up Britain, assuming that they showed no interest in the Highlands, because they didn't really go up there, the Romans. They went up the east coast of Scotland, all the way right up to the top. But on the west coast, they avoided the mountains, because they couldn't do anything with that. So if you disclude that, by the time 100 years had elapsed, probably about 30 or 40% of the southern bit of Roman Britain had sort of accepted the idea that the Romans were a good idea, that they were here to stay. But then the 60% then that went from sort of the middle into Wales and up towards Scotland, that 60% didn't. They didn't really want Rome as such, mainly the Brigantes. I mean, you had the trouble with Boudica, Boadicea, and the Iceni in East Anglia, going up the east coast from there. And they revolted and came down in the 60s, around about 61, 62 AD. They came down and caused a lot of trouble for the Romans. But by 63, they'd been defeated. They'd gone off the scene. And really, the Romans then were just trying to deal with the Brigantes, which brings us into 9th Legion territory.
Yeah, well, we'll get into more detail on that in a moment. I'll just set the scene a little bit more. I mean, you mentioned about the idea of Britain being seen as kind of like a, you know, a bridge too far almost, or, yeah. You know, there's some quotes that come up in the book or paraphrasing, which I loved, that the idea that it was in some people's mind, it was the last post of Atlantis, the last.
It was essentially.
Yeah. And also, yeah. I think the quote was, we will march anywhere in the world, but not out of it.
But not out of it.
Yeah. And
that's Claudius's troops. Yeah.
That's right. And there was his predecessor, Caligula, who, of course, was assassinated. The quote from him is the best one, I think. And he says, nature itself has removed Britain from the power and jurisdiction of the gods of Rome. To war beyond the bounds of nature is not courage, but impiety. And that kind of gives us a flavour of how Britain was regarded, you know, because obviously you think of mainland Europe today. And at one point, as far as European civilization was concerned, Britain would have been, or, you know, Ireland anyway, the British Isles would have been the edge of the world.
Yes, it is and has been. There's other twists in the tale as well, because Julius Caesar's biographer, Tacitus, he writes that if you wanted to be a Druid, for example, you could go to places in Gaul, which is sort of France now on the continent. You could go there to train as a Druid, but if you really wanted to be a Druid, you came to Britain, because Britain was the par excellence place for training Druids. It was the centre of the Druidic world. And it's interesting that in Gaul, in France in particular, the centre of the whole Druidic thing was at the source of the River Seine in the northern part of France. But when you look at where the source is, it's kind of approximately in the centre of the country. And in the quote from Tacitus, it says that the same thing applied to Britain, that in fact the Druids met in the centre of Britain. Well, the centre of Britain puts it somewhere up here, somewhere in the north of England. So that has a huge impact, because when you know that, it kind of tells you why the Romans were so interested in getting up here, basically around Chester, around the attack of the Druids on Anglesey. They went into the middle of the country. What they were doing, they were trying to get rid of that hardcore central Druidic and Celtic and cultural heartland, if you like. They were trying to break that up in order to conquer it. Of course, all that happened was it all scattered. They went into Wales, they scattered into Ireland, they scattered up to Scotland, so they never managed to completely get rid of it. But they certainly had a jolly good go. And that kind of sets the scene for where Britain is on a whole sort of European scale. Some people think the Celts of Ireland, because they survived the Roman impact, actually then started a reverse process, and they effectively re-civilized the continent, took it back again when the Romans disappeared. In fact, culture then spread back from Britain out across the rest of Europe. But it's kind of waves. It goes in waves. So it's not, that's not strictly true, but some people think it, that's how it worked. So we were, in the past, even then, quite a major player. As you say, if you headed this way, there wasn't anywhere else to go. Once you got to the west coast of Ireland, you had a long sail on your hands to get to anywhere else.
Okay, well, you mentioned that Julius Caesar had been in Britain around 55, maybe a bit later, BC.
55, 54, I think, and possibly 53 was when Julius was having a go.
Yeah, ultimately got his butt handed to him. Now, when
totally.
When Claudius became emperor, as you say, almost 100 years later, he had been a bit of an unlikely emperor. We don't need to go into his life story in great detail, but the point is, he came along, say, after Caligula was assassinated, and he had been a bit of a, he'd been kind of hidden away. As I understand it, Claudius was, they now think, had some form of disability, but certainly
I think he stammered.
Yeah, he wasn't sort of the obvious alpha male type who was going to stride into this position, but he became emperor and did at least realise that he needed to do something to kind of establish a reputation, to put his mark down. And this idea of returning to Britain, obviously, particularly where Caesar had failed, now if Claudius could succeed, that would be quite something. So it was in AD 43
absolutely.
That he first dispatched an invasion force. I think it was something like 40,000 men, 800 ships landing in Kent.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the history of Roman Britain expands, you know, hundreds of years after that. But the basic point is that he met with some success initially where Caesar hadn't. In to the extent that you can pick up the story here, but as I understand it, his troops were quite spooked by the idea, you know, as others had been before, about going to Britain. But when they eventually landed, for various reasons, the Britons had assembled to meet this invasionary force had kind of withdrawn and dissipated because they had heard that there was potential mutiny in the ranks. In any event, the initial progress that Claudius's forces were able to make was almost unopposed.
It was interesting the way it worked out. I think when they got here, they discovered that the civilization, the seeds of civilization that had been sown by Julius Caesar, I think had actually taken root. I think a lot of the Celtic culture that was here was gradually being given up in favour for the way that Romans did things, Roman technology and what have you. We were exporting to the continent. The Romans saw Britain as a source of, we were the biggest source actually of grain export, sheep wool. We did the best cloaks anywhere in the Roman Empire, so we were exporting those. Obviously various other products, including gold and silver, because gold and silver came from here. So I think the Romans were aware there was a very rich land here. They knew, had some idea of what they were heading for. They'd also encountered the Celtic culture on the continent and the Druidic culture, so they were very familiar with what type of civilization they were dealing with way before they got here. So when the invasion force arrived, of course, the south part that had already been touched, because it was facing Europe, it had already been touched by the Roman influence and by Caesar's advances, that particular part of Britain, was fine. Some of them were actually in favour of it. They were like, yes, come on, we don't mind this. We like square buildings and hypercourse and straight roads and this, that and the other. The rest of the forces, I think you're absolutely right when you say they deliberately backed off. They deliberately withdrew. There was a saying going around this time that a Roman's worst enemy was another Roman. And that was very much the case. So they literally just backed off and watched to see what the Romans would actually do. Whether they would implode and attack each other and get very greedy and fight amongst themselves, or whether the Romans could hold it together to actually start to advance up the country. But they got a lot of local help. They got a lot of help from people who were already effectively Romanized by Julius Caesar's and other traders coming across by what was going on. So in that sense, they got a lot of help. What they didn't get when they started coming north was any help from the tribes up here. They actually ran into tremendous opposition, and it went into one of the writings that I used for the production of the book was a letter. And in this letter, it's referred to as the British Wars. The Jewish walls are very famous, you know, all around the Roman historian network. People are aware of the Jewish walls, and that's mentioned in the same letter. But the British walls, nobody really has any details. That's where we go into the Ninth Legion. That's where they fit in.
As mentioned at the top of the hour, your book is entitled The Disappearing Ninth Legion. People will think, well, how did they disappear? What happened? That's the whole fascinating story. Let's just say something about the Ninth in a nutshell, because in many ways, they're just another Roman legion. Certainly, they excelled at various times in their history on the battlefield, and they had, you know, a long history before they ever came to Britain. Give us a little flavour of, you know, in some ways that they might have, what characterised them, you know, what made them different from any other legion. Each legion had its own particular traits, depending on where the soldiers were recruited from and what have you. And of course, the legion has the word Hispana, as in Spanish, attached to it, but of course they weren't Spanish per se.
No.
So just give us a flavour of that.
Well, one of the biggest things, one of the most important things with the Ninth Legion is the fact that before they came to Britain, they'd seen action on rivers and oceans. The Danube springs to mind as being one of the conflict zones against tribes there. They'd had experience on ships. So if you wanted to bring a legion across to Britain who were sort of au fait with, you know, crossing the channel, sailing with boats, being able to get around, I think by the time the Romans had planned to come to Britain, they'd realised that Britain was an island. But it had a lot of rivers. If you wanted to get anywhere, if you wanted to get across to Ireland or to Anglesey or to the Isle of Wight or wherever you wanted to go, it involved crossing salt water in one form or another. All the major river estuaries all the way up are all salt water as well. So basically, that legion was selected because it had skills on ships. They were sailors. They were known to be sailors. Both the 9th and the 20th had experience in sailing. They also had experience coming face-to-face with barbarians who had reputations at least as bad as the Celts in Britain. They'd fought the Germans, they'd fought Huns, they'd fought Goths, they'd fought all sorts of people on the continent, so they were aware of that fighting style and what they were up against. So I think that's probably the primary reason why they were selected to come to Britain. How they ended up in York is a bit of a mystery. I think they were assigned the job of moving up the east coast. I mean, they did other things. They also ended up in Chester, and they also ended up at Hadrian's Wall, and they did various other things, which all legions did. You tended to muck in. But the primary role that appears to be applied to the Ninth is that they were taking on people that they found going up the east coast. But their skills were mostly in sailing and shipping, which is one of the theories they have for how they disappeared.
We'll get into those theories, such as they are, towards the end. But just a little footnote, you mentioned the Ninth Legion's experience with shipping and navigation and what have you. When I was reading the book, I was reminded there's various points where you're recounting how, you know, such and such a legion moved from this part of Britain to the other part of Britain, and at various times they went by ship or, you know, travelled by sea, and people sort of think, well, where were they going by sea? But I was reminded of a book I read when I was a teenager, which we may actually have even mentioned in a different context in our first interview, but Brian Bates' book, The Way of Weird. I remember reading that for the first time. The protagonist, this is set in what is commonly called the Dark Ages. The protagonist gets into a boat, travels off somewhere, and then arrives on the shore, gets off the boat, and he's made his journey. And before it was revealed what he was doing, I remember thinking, okay, so by this length of time he spent on the boat, he's probably gone to France. But then, no, he just traveled to another part of England. The point being that the parts of Britain at that time were so densely forested that it would have been difficult to travel physically, but also dangerous for all sorts of reasons.
Well,
wild animals that are no longer populate these islands.
We had bears, we had lions, we had wolves, we had more snakes than we've got now. We had very large eagles that weren't above attacking children and villages.
Yeah, so this, the whole thing being, it's like, that seems counterintuitive, but there was a time when it would have been safer and faster to get on a boat, say, somewhere in East Anglia, and sail up to somewhere in Northumbria, you know, and get off there. Just
if you can march 30 miles in a day, but you could sail up a river estuary, once you get off the river estuary, you could almost get across the entire country in a couple of days from any given point in the British Isles. If you look where all the major river estuaries cut in, you could sail up to the highest point that you could get a boat, get off there, and then pretty much walk or ride by horse to any point in the entire UK. It was, for an island, for a long, narrow island, which is what we are, it was the absolute number one way of travelling. And if you had a friendly tribe up in the foothills of Scotland, in the lowlands, and they were friendly, but then all the tribes down the rest of the coast weren't, and you wanted to reach the friendly tribe, as you say, the best thing to do is jump on a boat and go round them.
Now, it's interesting when you look at the patchwork, the tribal patchwork of Britain at that time, or, you know, around that time. Obviously, again, it was a shifting pattern.
Yeah.
But how, you know, some were cooperative, some were very hostile, but also that could flip very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they could cooperate with the Romans at one minute and then just rebel in the next.
Yeah.
And vice versa. And all sorts of deals were being made and pacts. And I mean, it was in many ways, it was typical of just of tribal behavior, probably all over the world, but certainly in the British Isles at that time.
Well, the Brigantes actually physically did do that because Cartamandua, the queen, was having an affair with one of the courtiers. At the time, she was married to the king. And in order to get rid of the king, she actually gave the king up to the Romans because she was pro-Roman and he was anti-Roman. So she actually gave her own husband up to the Romans, who promptly arrested him and incarcerated him in Chester. So, I mean, that's the northern tribe. The Brigantes are sort of the big players, if you like, because they cover Lancashire, Yorkshire, North Cheshire, and they butt up against the Iceni at East Anglia. So they are all the way up then as far as the just above Hadrian's Wall. In fact, they think Hadrian's Wall actually was built to cut them in half, but they were certainly the biggest tribe in Britain. But there you have the Queen literally handing the King over to say, let's get rid of him. He's a problem. So the Romans did that. The Romans definitely took full advantage of tribal swings in allegiance.
It's divide and conquer again, isn't it? And if you can get get the people you want to conquer to divide themselves, you know, so much the better. I must admit, there's a pub here in York called Brigantes, and which I've frequented over the years. And for a while, I pondered the name, and I just thought, I wonder who Brigante was, because this is obviously
tribe.
I was thinking to myself, is it a person? In which case, if this is Brigantes, then you need an apostrophe before that S. thinking that there was some guy called Mr. Brigante who ran the
pub. Mr. Brigante.
Yeah. And then, and of course, later I discovered, it was like, ah, okay, that explains it.
Yeah, York's in that tribal area for the Brigantes. And they were certainly big enough to take on, well, more than one legion, as indeed they may well have done in the case of the Ninth.
They often show in popular culture, Rome is, I mean, I know there'll be sort of the counter aspect of this picture, but certainly in stuff, films I've seen and books I've read over the years, from a Roman perspective, it's very much that Rome is clean. They've got cutting edge, literally weapons and armor, techniques. They're organized. They've got tactics. They know what they're doing. You know,
All stolen from the other cultures that they conquer.
Exactly. And if you think of something, let's mention something that most people listening to this will have seen, the film Gladiator.
Yes.
You know, one of the opening early scenes is the confrontation in the forest, some ostensibly barbarians and a Roman legion. And you see the contrast in the fighting techniques. And as ferocious as the barbarians are, they're seen as kind of these just sort of filthy, subhuman sort of cavemen. You know,
yeah.
Who are ultimately trampled. And of course, that happened, but there's a much more nuanced patchwork, isn't there, here, when it comes to Roman conflict and conquest, and quite
well,
often...
Well, that battle is a good example of what not to do as a Roman, because the Romans were absolutely superb set-piece fighters. They had ways of doing things. But you, generally speaking, needed a reasonable amount of open space and firm ground to do that. If you could sucker them into a valley in the mountains or get them into woodland, which is what they're trying to do, the Goths in that particular sequence are trying to get them into the woods. If you do that, you can wipe them out. And the Teutoburg Wald in Germany in 9 AD, they marched a number of very large legions into the forest, the Commander Varus. And because of force of numbers, and because of the skills that the Goths and the Celts had in fighting in woodland, the whole shooting match got completely wiped out. It's one of the worst defeats in Roman history. And of course, when they came to this country, that is precisely what they're coming to face. They're coming to face these huge, vast numbers of Celts, Celtic warriors, who can easily wipe a legion out if you get them, you know, in the wrong area. If it favours them and it doesn't favour you, which is the reason why, at the end of the day, I think it was the 20th from Chester and from Anglesey legion that decided to take on Boudica and the Iceni. And as she's going down the east coast, they're cutting across from Anglesey, so they're coming down the Welsh borders and into the Midlands. The final conflict doesn't take place anywhere on the east coast. It takes place in the Midlands, because they've got open space. The Romans actually draw them into conflict when there's enough room to do so. So they're not entirely sure exactly where the battleground is, but that's down to Roman tactics. They tried to get them onto open space so that there was, because she vastly outnumbered the legion. I think the maximum amount of troops in the 20th legion was somewhere around 18,000 to 20,000. It's estimated there was over 80,000 of the Iceni, and they just swept, you know, through the forest, through the cities, through the towns. They just obliterated everything in the path. But when the Romans got them in a set-piece battle on open ground, they just defeated them because of the military tactics. So that's a very good example. The battle as well at the beginning of Gladiator only lasts about 8 minutes, and that in reality is about as long as a battle would last. By the time you've finished, after about 8 minutes, you're either dead or dying or exhausted. That's it. Battles didn't usually last more than that, unless people were going in waves as new fighters. You can keep a battle going that way, but certainly the initial clash is very accurately portrayed in Gladiator.
Yeah, the image of, as far as Britain's concerned, Romans coming up against, you know, warriors who were hiding in forests and, as you say, trying to draw them in, you know, because the Romans, the analogy is very much like a modern army. You know, they've got the best, the best hardware, and they've got all the plans worked out. Tying that in again with a modern idea would be coming up against an insurgency, or what the Romans would, if they had a word for it, might have referred to as terrorists, you know, people that would just pop up and do things that you couldn't predict.
In the Ninth Legion book and in the Green Man book, I actually mentioned that the Celts painted themselves using copper powder, and this copper paint would turn them green. So you can imagine, there's Julius Caesar with all his polished, you know, finery and his nice shiny armour and his standards and legions in red and yellow and orange and, you know, all these lovely bright colours, and they're all racked up on the beach. They cannot see the enemy. They're stood on the beach thinking, hang on a minute, where's everybody? Where the hell are they? Then all of a sudden, the grass, the trees, the bushes, the ferns, the woodland just comes alive. People just appear out of nowhere because they're green. They're all painted green. It's this camouflage powder. So there was more to it than just, well, I mean, it's the metal of the sun. They paint themselves in worship of the sun. It's also a sign of life. It also, if it gets inside wounds, stops people from dying of blood poisoning. But to cap it all, it's damn good camouflage. It's amazing camouflage. So the Celts knew a thing or two about a thing or two, definitely. The Romans weren't, you know, the might and power of Rome didn't always win over the subterfuge of the Celts, not by any means.
Okay, so to return to the Roman move north through Britain, they eventually, after, as I say, landing in AD 43, it was the year 71 when they established York, which they called Iberacum, which the Vikings later changed to Jorvik, or that was just their version of it. And it was
Iberacum's the place of the ewes, I believe, is the meaning of that.
Okay, right, you live and learn. And it was the Ninth Legion who constructed the fortress at York.
Yeah, it's interesting because that's an aspect of York's history that they don't seem to push in the city itself as much as they should do. There's a great interest in Vikings in York, and they seem to push the whole idea of it being a Viking city, but it was not there, it didn't exist, until the Ninth Legion came and actually built its legionary fortress. The legionary fortress is the centre, the core, if you like, of the current main city of York. Like you say, they arrived in 71. It was founded probably about 10 years after Chester, so they kind of came up the 20th, up to Chester, founded that, did the reconnaissance, and then they were followed up the east coast then in around about 71 by the 9th. So, yeah, they are responsible for the founding of the city of York. all the Roman infrastructure that the archaeologists are finding that's sort of below ground, things like sewers and foundations and basements and the walls themselves, it's all the work of the Ninth.
It's just to remind ourselves of the emperor timeline, shall I call it here, relating to York. We mentioned earlier it was Claudius who initiated the invasion. In the meantime, he was replaced by Nero. And then it was Vespasian, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, who was emperor when York was established.
Yes, he was, because you've got quite a few between sort of Nero and Vespasian.
Yeah, the thing, I think the reason that they get skipped over is because they weren't big players, and some of them only were in place for a few months and what have you.
Yeah, but it's Vespasian, he's the big player. He's just finished sorting out the Middle East, actually, believe it or not. That was his role before he came to Britain. And he's the one responsible then for the gigantic legionary capital fortress at Chester, and then the outlying forts here in the north. It's mostly Vespasian that's responsible for, certainly for the timber versions of those, for starting them. And then he's followed by Titus, which is one of his sons, I believe. And Titus takes over and continues it. So between them, they pretty much consolidated the north as far as they could, as far as the Celts would let them.
Yeah, there weren't very many Roman emperors who were sort of father and son that took over from each other. Funny, we're talking about York, one other famous example,
Constantius and Constantine.
Yeah, that's right. Constantine the Great, as he's known. And they're very relevant in the history of York and of Christianity, of course. But for York, we're looking at something eventually covering 50 acres, you know, thousands, of course, soldiers, as you mentioned earlier. Yeah. As far as the Ninth Legion are concerned, once York was established, as you say, other Romans had established other settlements and cities in the meantime. What can you say about the sort of the adventures or the timeline of the Ninth in Britain after that point, you know, after their building work in York was done?
Well, it's difficult to say whether they would have had a sort of a chronological sequence of adventures. It was more a case of, once they got in there, the troops that went into York initially would have moved whoever was at this place of the ewes, Eboracum. They would have moved those people away, which probably would have upset some of the locals, because in the book I actually conjecture that the place of the ewes sounds more like somewhere that the Druids were established. So either they were friendly and they let them in, or they weren't friendly and they ejected them. So they would have started principally with building a timber campaign fort of some substance and size. I don't think they would have messed about with that. I think it would have been very large right at the beginning, because they would have needed the defence. They're in a really, really bad place, outpost-wise, they're in the middle of nowhere, and they're faced by enemies on every side. So then I think after that, by the time you get to the point that the city's being established, I think they've slightly changed the function. If you're a marine, a maritime legion, you would be very familiar with woodworking and timber work and what's necessary to maintain shipping. Whereas by the time you get to the Ninth Legion we're talking about, the version we're going on about, they've actually decided at the end of the first century to rebuild this timber fortress after a period of about 30 or 40 years. They're going to rebuild it in stone. So obviously the skill base, the generation that built the timber fortress, is declining, and the generation that's now in there are people interested more in building in stone, tile, brick, marble, anything they can get their hands on. So the town now is slightly swinging away from out-and-out warfare. It's going more into its commercial phase, which is, as you say, huge. It covers a huge acreage outside the fort as well. But somewhere between the establishment of the timber fort and the stone fort, there's a good possibility they also crossed to Chester and assisted the 20th over in Chester in building that. So I would venture to say, I would stick my neck out and say that the guys in Chester probably trained up a lot of the people that were skilled in stonework and built up the skills base in order for them to then transfer over to York and start to build that in stone. So you're dealing with mostly with consolidation. There's some archaeological evidence of a couple of conflicts here and there. There's a couple of burnt forts and one or two defensive lines that we can pick out where the Romans are edging further north. The Mersey Valley was one of them. Before they crossed the Mersey into Lancashire, they declared a sort of war zone there, which presumably stretched across and then went up diagonally to incorporate York. Everything seems to go up at 45 degrees up towards the east coast, so they'd obviously got a lot higher on that side than they had on the west. And they seem to be consolidating that. So the guys working in timber would have basically had the work cut out, because they would have had to build other defences and signal towers and various other things away from the fortress. But when you get to the sort of critical bit, if you like, one of the critical pieces of evidence is this development of the fortress in stone, because that gives us a date. Well, there's actually a date for the 9th, which is the last secure date we have for them as being in York. Well, in the process of redeveloping it, there's actually an inscription which was found during some development work in very close to one of the gates in York. And because of the nature of Latin inscriptions, Roman inscriptions, we can date this one pretty accurately to the... it was actually found in King's Square, and it was dedicated to the Emperor Trajan. And because of the nature of the Latin, we know that it can only date from either the year 107 or 108 AD. And that is the last piece of written evidence for the ninth in this country, is 107 to 108 AD. That's the only thing that's been found anywhere that can date them to that last period. So somewhere between 107 and 108, they just finished putting this gateway up, this new gateway, on the first quarter of the rebuild. So if you imagine a fort as a square, they're rebuilding sort of the lower corner, if you like. So you've got two gates, one in the centre of each wall. Let's say, hypothetically, one on the west wall and one on the south wall. And what they've done is they've built the two gates and then joined the bit in between with the necessary stonework and the towers. And then when they've finished doing that, on one of the gateways, probably the one which is the south gate, as I remember, they stuck this inscription to it. And that gate then was completed between 107 and 108 AD. And that is the last secure date we have for anybody from the 9th in this country. So that's really important.
It's amazing that for a legion that had distinguished itself over the centuries and kind of done so much, that many commentators and writers, you often see them referred to now as the unlucky ninth.
From that date, everything started going wrong. It's all downhill from there. That's when the problems begin.
Perhaps you should throw some light on that, and then...
Okay, yeah. Well, basically, what happens somewhere after 108, so we're after that date, they would have had to continue to build the rest of the fortress in stone. So when we were writing the book, The Ninth Legion, we made the assumption that although the rest of the inscriptions haven't been found yet, there's still another two gates, the one on the north and the one on the east, plus three corners in between, all of which needed to be replaced in stone. So we're working on the assumption that they carried on doing that. It would have probably taken them a few years to achieve that. Then looking at the other circumstances, other things taking place around Britain, we managed to narrow it down to probably somewhere between, say, 117 and 119 AD is the time when they literally would not have done any more to York. By the time you've examined all the archaeology, you've looked at the circumstances, by that point they've then finished all the rebuild and the town is established as we find it now archaeologically. What is really interesting, though, is there's no evidence that York was ever destroyed. So we know that's not where the 9th Legion were attacked. Nobody ever decided to take York on. They didn't attack the fortress, they didn't attack the city, there's no burnings, no destruction, there's no piles of dead bodies, nothing that you would normally find archaeologically associated with the attack on York itself. So that enables us then to say, right, whatever happened to the Legion, it happened away from the legionary base. They had to move out away from the legionary base, and basically they got nobbled somewhere else. We know then from Roman records that probably the best direction they were heading was north, because that's where the trouble was. They're marching, whichever direction they leave, they're marching into Brigantes territory. At this point, we think possibly 70, 80, 90,000 Brigantes could be massed, plus anybody else they could get for support from other tribes. And we think that actually the 9th Legion probably marched out through one of their brand new, nice, shiny gates, They marched out in the spring or the summer of 119 AD, heading north, and were promptly obliterated as they got into the lowlands of Scotland. We do put several suggestions. There are quite a lot of scenarios, actually, for the end of the Legion. I think there's about 12 or 13 different versions in the book of all the theories that have been put forward. But the one we favour most is that they actually arrived in the area somewhere near Rannoch Moor, or just south of Rannoch Moor, between Rannoch Moor and Hadrian's Wall, in that area there, and that's where the final conflict, as it were, took place. Surrounded and massacred, very much like what happened in Germany, which neatly explains why the Romans didn't bother to record it. And there's a little bit of conspiracy creeping in there, if you want me to go into that in a bit more detail.
Oh yeah, well, yeah, by all means, you know, why not? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Well, what happens next is interesting, because you've got to bear in mind at this point, Britain has no walls. There's no idea of building a wall. Hadrian then comes into power as emperor around about 120 AD, which is the following year. Some of Hadrian's troops then turn up in the British Isles, and they turn up in York, some of them, perhaps to discover that York actually only has one or two soldiers and an administrative structure, because the vast majority of them have gone. They've all been wiped out. They then discover what's happened in these British wars. They find out that the Legion's basically been wiped out. Hadrian is then following them. He's coming the following year in 121 AD. So they then have to sort this little problem out. When Hadrian gets here, what he's doing, he's walling off the limitae, the outer border of the sacred Roman Empire, because the soil inside Rome is sacred. It belongs to Rome, it belongs to the Roman gods. Beyond that limitae, beyond that notional boundary, that notional border, is not Rome. You're outside the jurisdiction of the gods of Rome and the power of Rome. He's already built that all the way across northern Europe. He's gone across with walls and fortifications, and most people forget about these, and there are quite a lot of them surviving in Germany that come all the way across. And actually, Hadrian's Wall is the last bit of that process. It's the last bit of the wall. And what he does, rather cannily, is he cuts right through the middle of the Brigantes. So he slices all the tribes in half, puts a massive amount of fortification in. I mean, Hadrian's Wall in this country is really substantial. It's a huge, huge system of defences. He puts that all the way across. And then this is where the cover-up comes. There's no record of the disappearance of the ninth. There's no surviving paperwork, nothing. Just this passing reference in Fronto's letter about this British war. And then all the coins that he then mints for this country all show troops on the reverse side, Roman troops, saluting him as he arrives, and they've got the standards, they've got all the banners, they've got everything, and what he's clearly declaring is, I have beaten the Brits, and look, the legions are not missing. Here they are on the back of my coins. They greeted me as I marched into this country. And when you look at it, they've also got Britannia as well, looking very miserable and looking down with a shield and a spear, very much like we used to have on the old pennies. They've got a sat there looking really miserable on the back. And that is Britannia Conquest as well. He's issuing this other set of coins with Britannia being crushed on the back, or looking crushed. And it's all about spin, because the coin has got, you know, a god on one side, which is the emperor himself, his face, so that you don't deface Roman coins. That's where the idea of not defacing coinage comes from, because it's a sacred image. And when you turn it over, it's basically got the sacred spin on the other side. You've got this idea that they haven't lost a legion, they haven't lost anybody. Oh, look, there they are, they're on the back of the coins. They were here when he rode in. When in actual fact, in the case of York, they weren't. Chances are it was deserted, apart from its administration staff. So you can see this. And you could almost therefore say, and I'm sticking my neck right out here as a historian and archaeologist, you could actually say the massacre of the Ninth and the disappearance of the Ninth, the direct consequence of that is the building of Hadrian's Wall. That is the direct consequence. Had the Ninth not been massacred, the wall may have finished up more like the Antonine Wall, that's higher up, just made of timber and banks. as opposed to what we've got now, which is this massive, great, long stone structure with forts all the way along it. We do know a couple of people survived from the 9th, because there's some evidence that the 20th, the stonemasons, moved up from Chester and probably took some of the surviving masons from the 9th up and assisted in the building of the wall. But there's no evidence whatsoever for the military legion. It's gone.
Well, yeah, it's quite a theory. Much of the Roman fortress that was in York lies under the foundations of York Minster, you know, the cathedral in York.
Yeah, and some really nice bits under there.
Yeah, well, the excavations that they did under there in the late 60s and early 70s revealed some of the original walls. And, of course, there's the museum there now, the Undercroft, has interpretation in there of, you know, from archaeologists and historians just giving their version of what they think happened.
Yeah.
And the one that focuses on the bit that focuses on the 9th Legion acknowledged that there's all sorts of theories going around there. No one really knows what happened to the 9th. But it's interesting that the one that they go with, the only one they explicitly mention, is the one that sees the Legion going over to what today is the Netherlands, where they were either disbanded or destroyed. They don't discount the idea that they were wiped out. That's the one they chose from, and that's one of the ones, of course, that you mentioned in the book.
The interesting twist in that, they have a habit of rotating legions clockwise around the Empire, so you could always predict where the Legion was going to get stationed next, because they never tended to leave the legions where they were for more than a set period, and then they'd move them. So I think you're referring to Nijmegen, which is, I think it's in Holland. That was the next place they ended up moving to. And the reason that that is cited is because there is tilework and brickwork carrying a stamp which quite distinctly has 9 on it, okay? But the twist, and this is where the twist comes in, the British stamps for the 9th Legion, it's got, as you rightly say, Hispania, all the rest of it, IX. But the ones at Nijmegen, which is really interesting, for some reason they've gone with V, I. I. It's all done with the eyes. So the stamp is actually different. It's the same, it appears to be the same legion, it still appears to be the 9th, but it seems that they went there to reform it. So the consensus, I mean, I'm going through all the theories, is that whatever fragments of the 9th were discovered by Hadrian when he moved into York, those fragments were gathered together and formed the core, if you like, of what later became the Unlucky 9th, and that what he did then as part of the spin was to change the branding, if you like, to alter the number 9 so that the whole legionic stamps and everything were different. They weren't the same as the ones that were used at York. So when you look at the detail, because the devil's in the detail, something's changed. Between York and Nijmegen, something has altered as the legion has moved across. And then I'm in favour of that. I think that is a theory that actually, yes, I think that's possibly what he would have done. And then they're reformed, and then they get deployed into this thing called the Jewish War. And the Jewish War raged right into the 160s AD. So they raged for about 40-odd years in total. And I think actually that they got hammered again. This is where they get this epithet, unlucky. I think they got hammered again, and I don't think they walked away from the Jewish War. I think that was the last straw. So I think you've got one version of the 9th Legion, which quite justifiably vanished over here in the British Wars at York, and then, if you like, the reinvented, rebranded, reconstructed Legion then, which got involved in the Jewish Wars, just got hammered again. And then they just forgot about it. They never reformed it after that.
As we begin to draw things to a close for today, Mark, my thought is that it's entirely possible that we'll never know what happened here. But equally, it amazes me, living here in York, and the same can be said, the same can be said about other Roman settlements, comparing what has been found so far in terms of archaeology versus what must remain still buried, because of all the amazing artifacts and archaeology that was dug up around, for example, York Minster and other parts of York, of course, that's nothing compared to the size of the city. Now, of course, no matter how enthusiastic you are as an archaeologist, no one really advocates digging up the entire city.
Don't think anyone could.
Yeah, well, exactly, down to a depth of however many feet.
Yeah.
Not possible, can't happen without literally destroying the city. But again, we can only speculate, can't we, about what might be down there and what clues it might give us. And as true of any archaeology, I suppose, like most of what most of what has gone before is either completely destroyed, it's atomized, or it's buried and will never be seen.
Yes, that's pretty true. I have to say, though, that modern technology might come to our aid in this at some point in the future. There's a very close friend of mine who does satellite archaeology, which is a brand new discipline, which is the examination of various satellite images, different resolutions, different photographs, different radar scans, things like that. He has had a look, actually, on my behalf to see where there is evidence, perhaps, for the Massacre of the Ninth, and he has honed in on a series of burial mounds that are up there in Scotland, between Rannoch and the Hadrian's Wall. And these mounds that he's honed in on, which he found using satellite, he's then gone off and done a little bit more research, and on the earlier maps, the Victorian maps and maps that have been produced for Scotland from before that date, it quite clearly says on these old maps, Roman burial mounds. Not Celtic, not tumulus, not prehistoric, it quite clearly says on them, Roman. So I suspect that we may actually have found them at the end. It's not in the book, because we hadn't done it when we finished the book. We've done it subsequent to that. So we kind of may know where they are, and at some point in the future, when technology gets to the point where they can see through the ground without digging it up and destroying it, I think that's where they are. I think they're hidden under the burial mounds in southern Scotland with the word Roman written on the map.
Well, history is a story that's still being written. We've just scratched the surface of a few aspects of the Roman Empire here and their time in Britain. And I would urge anyone who's interested at all to look further at this, particularly given the times that we live in, because when we were talking earlier off air, there was a great quote that I'll get you to repeat in a second. But, you know, if we refuse to consider what has gone before, then we are laying traps for ourselves as we try to move forward. And I think there's a lot we could reflect on now about the beginning, the rise, the fall of Rome that would be applicable to trajectory that we find ourselves on now.
Well, let me say, Disappearing Ninth Legion as a book, we had two things in mind when we actually produced this particular version of the book. The first thing was to write a book that if you were, let's say you were a tourist, you'd got in the car, you're heading to York, you're thinking, oh, I know all about the Vikings all over the internet. What we wanted was a book that someone could read in a car journey, so you can probably read it in, let's say, a maximum of 2 hours, certainly less than 2 hours. Something you could read that would then effectively make you an expert in the Roman aspects of York and what's been discovered. So that was one thing we were aiming for. And the second thing was to come up with a popular history of, if you like, the first half of the Romans in Britain. It brings you up to around about the end of the second century. So it takes you through the first 250 or so years of the Roman occupation of Britain. So in the process of reading about the Legion, you're also learning about the Romans and the Roman Empire. So I think the book kind of hits the mark with both of those. I think it's possible that you could become an expert in the ninth by reading it, and you'd certainly know a lot more about the first half of the Roman Empire here in Britain. The book I'm writing at the moment is going to cover the second half. The quote was given by Her Majesty the Queen when she gave her address at the turn of the millennium, and she quite poignantly stated that Winston Churchill had said, "The further we look back, the further ahead we can see," which in a sense is saying that really, if we want to know what's coming up and we want to see the future, we want to know what's going to happen, just look to the past, because patterns have a habit of repeating themselves. And if you don't look back, you don't learn from the mistakes of the past. So if nothing else, you know, we need to be looking back, looking at what's happened and improving. Let's stand on the shoulders of giants. Let's make things better and improve and move things forward, rather than forgetting about the past, making the same mistakes and falling into the same pit again.
Okay, well, Mark, today, as you just mentioned, we've been talking about your book, The Disappearing Ninth Legion. That's widely available. Anything else you'd like to share with listeners? I think, remember last time you didn't have a website as such, but just put anything out there that you would care to.
Okay, if people want to contact me, probably the best way to do it is give me a friend application on Facebook. It's a lot more personal than a website, and it's probably the easiest way of doing it. Don't bombard me with you know, Bubble Witch Saga and all that sort of stuff, or I'll unfriend you fairly quickly. But if you want a serious communication, please feel free to contact me via Facebook. You can dash out and, of course, buy the book, Disappearing Ninth Legion. There's The Green Man, Revealing the Green Man. That one's out. There's one called The Life and Times of the Real Robin Hood, Robynhode. That will come up because that was the last one in print. And I can't really leave you in suspense. I've got to say, the next book I'm working on is King Arthur. And we've got a working title for that. It's The Polychronicon of Joseph, Merlin and Arthur. So that's coming up, but that probably won't be available until Christmas this year, I would think, at the earliest, because it's a bit of a monster. But that deals with the second part of the Roman Empire in Britain and takes you right through the Dark Ages.
Wonderful. Well, Mark, once again, thank you so much for joining us today on LegaliseFreedom.com.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegaliseFreedom.com. That's LegaliseFreedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegaliseFreedom.com.